I'm just proud of myself for going in and like doing the uncomfortable thing and hope to God that I don't have this doesn't have to be a regular thing for me.
Agreed. Is now the coffee sipping pod.
Yes, it is. I like this so much. I like, no, but it's like 8 o'clock in the morning here, and I'm just like having a cup of coffee with my BFF in the morning.
Isn't that glorious?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Blair.
And I'm Kirsten, and we are
Mediocre
Content. And we've done an episode sort of like this before.
Indeed, we have. We have done alcohol episodes.
We have.
That is true.
But this one is special, of course. Is it specific, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful, I guess. I don't really like sake, I'm going to be honest.
I don't think I've ever had sake before. I've
Yeah.
just never like had the opportunity to have it.
Tyler is an enthusiast. Like,
Interesting.
he likes to try all the vibes.
Yeah.
And the other part to this is actually, even though I haven't really found a sake I'm into, I like soju. Is that how you say it?
Oh yeah.
That's actually
Soju,
really
I've
good.
heard, is really good.
Yeah. It's definitely still has a burn to it, but the flavors are so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I Okay, so like follow me here. In my brain,
Stalking, got it.
I feel like so like I really enjoy vodka and gin, which are like
Okay.
clear, alcohols. And I feel like I like them and they sit the best with me because for of my heritage, which is
Okay.
very white people, okay? And not like and I feel like Tyler liking sake has nothing to do with that, which disproves my theory
Was gonna say, where are you going with
immediately.
that? Because he's literally like from Wales.
Right. Right. And he's a ginger,
And he's
so
a ginger. Same, same.
yeah. I don't know why my brain just does that,
That's
but
funny.
like it was just for me. Everybody else can do what they want, but like for me, that's what I felt like.
I mean, in your logic, I am a beer and like a local brew kind of person if I'm gonna drink.
Sure.
I would feel, given the fact that my brother Chris literally drinks Michelob Ultra, I feel like we're just two different people, you know?
Yeah.
We come from two
Yeah.
different lines. Not that there's anything wrong with Michelob, it's not something I drink. But I love the sours and the stouts
So do I.
and exploring the IPAs and the wheat beers. It's so fun.
You
Okay.
lose me at the IPAs and the stouts, but I do like sours and I
Yeah.
like wheat beers. Yeah.
Yeah. I love the I don't know which company it was, but there's a local company around here that does like a fruit punch sour situation. It is
Nice.
so good. And I feel like sometimes the sours just they're like it's just a sour beer and you get like maybe a drop of the flavoring.
Yeah.
This you feel like you're actually drinking like maybe like a fizzy fruit juice, and it's
Yeah.
wonderful.
One of our favorite local breweries to go to, they have in the summertime, they have slushies that are also
Oh,
sours,
so
and they're
good.
so good. I love them so much.
The last time we went to Tennessee, which I don't remember when it was
Yeah.
maybe last year sometime. But if you've never been to the Gatlin Forge Pigeon Gatlinburg Fit Pigeon Forge area, you need to go because they have this strip line of stores and shops. They have breweries where you could get quote free taste testing. They're not allowed to advertise it like that, but you get the point. You get to taste all the alcoholic stuff for free, for the most part, or you pay like a small fee, like a dollar, and you get like the full flavor profile. Anyway, none of that matters. What matters is they have recently opened cider breweries, and in the cider breweries, they are taking these wine bottle like size what did I just say? Ciders. My brain pooped for a
It's
second. When
okay. It's fine.
they're taking this whole packet, putting it in one of those freezy packets that you would normally make daiquiris in, and you can make these delicious cider slushies. We bought like four to try and like a whole package. And of course, they're doing like, if you buy one, you get the. And of course, we did because, oh my gracious, it tastes, you, there's zero alcohol taste. Like, so dangerous, but so good. I'm
And it
so
comes in
excited.
like the fruit punch or like the Capri Sun packaging, kind of.
No, it's just a giant bag. You
Oh,
have to
just a
pour it
giant bag.
yourself, which
Oh, okay.
difficult but delicious.
But delicious. I like it. I like it.
I agree with you. The slushies are the best. I love a good daiquiri. What can you say? I don't know.
Put an umbrella in any drink, really.
Oh,
I'm there for it, you know?
I'll put an umbrella in a beer. Don't tempt me.
Yeah.
This
New
vacation's starting
thing.
right now.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Anyway.
Well, now that we've gotten that out of the way, we're gonna disclaim, and as per usual, if you've listened to any other podcast that we've ever done, you'll know that we are not experts on anything. We usually do the best we can to research the best we can, but you know how the internet can be. If you have come here to get any kind of advice, we are not the place to get that. Also, this being an alcoholic podcast, the way that I phrase that is silly, but you know what I mean. This being the subject being alcohol, everybody just drink responsibly, be careful. We are your internet moms, so just, you know, be diligent and careful and aware of your surroundings when you're drinking at all times, especially if you are of the female variety.
And if you need assistance with any alcohol-related issues, make sure you're calling your local authorities or Alcohol Anonymous courses and getting the help that you need. And this is not a promotion of alcohol drinking.
That's right. So with that, I'm going to do the good news, and I literally do not remember anything about this. So I did this so long
Professionals!
ago. So we're gonna find out what this is together, okay?
Wonderful. I'm so excited.
All right. So this one is I titled Rope Climbing Woman. So we'll
So
see.
ambiguous.
So ambiguous. Remember the free hanging rope climb exercise in PE class? No, because they didn't make us do that.
Was about to say,
But
I do not.
in every movie
They
ever,
do.
they
Yeah,
do. So
especially
anyway.
with the American culture movies.
Yeah, like the high school setting movies. Yeah. Okay, so apparently people like to climb ropes for fun. French woman Anouk Garnier, her new world record for rope climbing is amazing. Let's see. So climbing 360 feet or 110 meters in 18 minutes allowed her to climb up through the center of the Eiffel Tower into the iron bosom of the second floor, which I didn't know that's what the second floor of the Eiffel Tower was called. her attempt was in this the name of raising money for cancer research and prevention after her mother was diagnosed with the disease. The previous world record, The Guardian reports, was held by the South African athlete Thomas van Tonder, who t climbed about 300 feet up a rope suspended between the Soweto Towers in Johannesburg,
How
which is in
many
South Africa.
Lincoln memorials are those?
I don't know, honey. I don't know. Girl,
Give me measurements.
I don't know. And if you don't know why we're le measuring in Lincoln memorials, please go to YouTube.
Also, we measure in Washington monuments, apparently.
Yes, also that.
Hashtag America.
Quote, my dream has come true. It's magical, Garnier to told the Gal. And I'm saying Garnier because it's spelled like the shampoo and she's French, so I'm assuming that's what it is.
Garnier Fructis.
told the gathered media. All right, so if there's one thing I've never doubted, it was that I was going to do it. I've never stopped believing in it. The satisfaction and joy I derive from it today are all the greater. It is a crazy dream come true. So congratulations to her.
That's amazing.
it is amazing. Let's see. So she won the World Obstacle Course Championship for her age category in 2022. And the same year, she decided to go for the Stensgaard record of 26 meters, which she described thinking wasn't that high.
Oh my gosh.
When she first heard about it. Garnier will be carrying the Olympic torch at Marseille in May for leading up to the Summer Olympics.
That's so cool.
Yes.
Aw, all for her mommy. That's cute.
I know. Very nice. So the second one I have for you guys is Eclipse Party. It is, by the time this comes out, I think the eclipse will probably be about a month ago, but yeah. We're going to talk about this anyway.
Okay.
The year was 1978. Prime Minister Aldo Moro had been kidnapped in Italy. The U.S. senatorial proceedings were broadcast on the radio for the first time. And Patrick Moriarty was teaching his junior high science class about solar eclipses. Explaining their trajectory, the path of totality, and other such details, the class took a look at it, which upcoming eclipses would pass over their hometown of Rochester, New York. Quote, hey, circle that one on April 8th, 2024, Moriarty recalled telling his students, we're going to go to that one together. Laughing, the class carried on the lesson, and every new group of 17-year-olds that came through his class got the same joke with inevitably the same reaction. The years went by, the Berlin Wall fell, and dot-com bubble crashed in the stock market. This is a very articulate article.
Very articulate.
Very setting the scene.
Yes.
The U.S. elected a black man to be president. Social media embedded itself in our lives, and then suddenly Moriarty was looking at the calendar, and it said 2022. He always used to tell his students that he'd take out an ad in the newspaper, but since people don't really do newspapers anymore, he set up a Facebook group to track down some of his old charges and see if his promise meant as much to them as it did to him. But he didn't expect much 40 to 50 years on, on as one might imagine. So the group soon circulated among former students who kept up connections, and hundreds expressed interest in the event. Soon plans began to take shape, and Moriarty hired a local pizzeria to cater the event and bought 130 pairs of eclipse glasses.
Oh my God.
Then came the big day. The head spinning reconnection began with all the students whose faces Mr. Moriarty mostly did not remember, but whose names he did.
Fair enough.
The students came from all over the country with children, with life stories, and with 45 years of experiences to share. Jokes were made. You seem taller, said one. This one has got to be the longest homework assignment ever, said another.
So, do I get an A?
In the hour before the eclipse, Moriarty was back in class teaching a variety of middle-aged students exactly as he once did about the science behind the eclipse. Eventually, the moon passed over the sun, but even the spectacular stargazing event couldn't eclipse the incomprehensible moment shared between strangers who were nevertheless bound by an almost 50-year joke.
That is so cute.
Quote, when teachers go into education, they hope that they can be the kind of teacher that would have an impact on people and make a difference for people, Moriarty, 68, told the Washington Post's Kyle Melnick. Quote, and this event right here just firmed it up for me that I guess I did okay.
My God, I think I saw like a video about this at some point.
Yeah,
it's so stinking cute, and they all came. Like,
I know.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
I know. So there are a lot of terrible things about being a teacher, but I feel like there's always a bright side. So.
For sure. My favorite teacher was my fifth grade teacher. Miss Berlinghoff, if you listen to this, don't listen. Just cover your ears. You're still a favorite teacher. Don't worry. But one of my favorite teachers growing up was my fifth grade teacher, Miss Post. And I will remember her forever. She was like really like down to earth.
Was her first name Emily?
I don't know.
I'm just asking because Emily Post is like a very... advice column-y name.
Oh, really? No,
it's like the I don't know. Anyway, never mind.
Yeah, I don't know. Then I think fourth grade was Miss Young. Third grade, I have no recollection for some reason. I don't know. But Miss Post was my fifth grade teacher, and I loved her very much, and she was fabulous. Miss Berlinghoff is fantastic too. She had me all through high school, and she was our youth group pastor. So
very nice.
Anyway, do you have a favorite teacher? Have we talked about this?
I don't think so. I mean, I had a lot of really good professors in college that I
True,
loved.
true.
Shout out Kathy. I also, let me think. In elementary and high school, though, I don't really know.
Hey, if they didn't make an impact, though,
Yeah, I
that's
don't know.
fair.
We're not really. I mean, they were fine. I was just like not. I was just
Yeah.
trying to get through. You know what I'm saying? Like
It's just trying to make
there were
it.
classes that I had a fun time, but I think I just had so much anxiety like during that
Yeah.
time that I was just like, okay, I can't, like, I'm just gonna do my work and hope for the best.
Yeah. Miss Griffey is one I'm also still friends with. She was my French teacher all through high school.
Wow.
Yeah.
Such a teacher's pet you are.
Well, we already knew this.
Yeah, we did. It goes with the grandma aesthetic.
Anyway, something that might not go with the grandma aesthetic is sake. It's
True, true.
true. So anyway, we like we said in the beginning, we have done an alcohol history lesson before. This was actually, I think, one of our first ones, if I'm not mistaken. It was like within the
Yeah.
first couple months. And that one was really fun, but this one is very specific. And honestly, with the history of alcohol being at the forefront, the reality is there's so many different kinds of drinks, right? Like beer, wine, you have cocktails, cider, obviously sake, soju. It just depends on what kind of country you're from, what kind of resources they're available, and we really honestly could do some kind of lesson on all of them individually because of how much of a rich history they have and a lot of cultural impact, such as this one. So, as usual, we'll start with a little bit of that history and the difference between like beer and sake, for example, and even wine. Like wine is grapes and other fruits, and beer is usually wheats and barleys and things like that. Sake is actually fermented rice based. And the technique for this fermented rice in an alcoholic drink was developed actually in ancient China, though I think these days you associate sake a lot with Japan. So there's just a little bit of difference in its roots. It did arrive to Japan along with rice cultivation around 2,500 years ago, and since then Japanese people have continued to refine this production method and make it really unique and end up calling it sake. So our earliest records are around the 2nd century BC, and this is the record of rice brewing technique, and this was what was brought from China. So scholars believe that rice-based alcoholic beverages originated in China, where the rice cultivation would have started about 7,000 years before. This also includes the development of the unique method using fungi to brew alcohol from this grain. However, drinks resembling sake only exist in Japan today, which is an interesting fact. Alcoholic rice-based drink production in Japan dates as far back as that 5th century BC when it arrived, basically, from China. And then 3rd century AD is the first record of existence of sake in Japan, which is the written record, is what they're looking at. And that's kind of how they use all of these dates and things like that. But of course, the 3rd century historical Chinese document stated, people in Japan drink sake. They drink in groups when they are mourning, which is interesting. Like, that's the first written record of it.
Yeah.
And
Not
then
the
the.
first time an alcoholic beverage has made an appearance in a state of
It's
mourning.
true. It's very true. And the first domestic record appears in that 8th century history book, which is kind of cool.
Interesting.
Of course, what happens in most cases when there's a new commodity on the market, it usually goes to the wealthier people first because they have access to it. And keep in mind, a lot of it's imported until rice production really took off in Japan. So now you have to account for the fact that you are paying to get it there and then paying to maintain it there. So this second part of its early history is in the imperial court system. So in 689 AD, sake brewing division was established in the imperial courts. So by the 8th century, when Nara housed the ruling imperial court, Sake frequently appeared in domestic documents. Notably, one document hinted that brewers used mold to make sake, likely indicating the use of koji, which is a different style, is my understanding. And in 689, the imperial court created a special division that governed sake brewing. At the time, only the privileged had access to the drink, most likely restricting to the imperial court officials and religious leaders. And records show that in the summertime, in particular, the emperor and aristocrats would enjoy sake chilled with ice cubes. And if you don't know, there's a couple different ways you can make sake and, prepare it for your company. And we'll talk about that later.
I have a question.
I might have an answer.
I don't know if you do, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So,
Okay.
you know how, like, in the Middle Ages, they were mostly drinking beer in Europe because it was better than the drinking water? Did Japan have adequate drinking water, or was this like their version of beer at the time?
I don't know about the water situation.
Okay.
But at the same time, I think it's mostly cultural. And
Okay.
if you're from Japan or know a lot about Japan or Asian culture in general, correct me if I'm wrong, but even today there's a strong drinking culture in places like Japan and South Korea in particular. So I think it's more like, even if they had good drinking water, I think it just became part of the norm
Okay.
more than any,
Okay.
like just a social gathering
Yeah, so,
situation.
but it would be more like special occasions and not just
Right.
like all the time.
I would assume,
Yeah.
but I might be wrong. Because even now, like after work, from what I understand, I mean, the working
Yeah.
culture over there is insane as well. So, from what I've heard, a lot of them will just go after work every day and have a drink at a
Yeah,
bar, but with friends,
reasonable.
yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, I don't know about their drinking water though.
Okay.
I would imagine if they're if they're concerned about mold brewing, which we'll talk about,
Yeah.
they probably weren't. I mean, I don't know. All I can think about when I think about drinking water is like the Roman aqueducts, like how
That's
good they
fair.
had
Yeah.
it.
All right.
Everybody else was kind of late to
If you
the
know
game.
the answer to this question,
Yeah.
please let us know.
Yes, please. And we could even do, I wonder if we could do a podcast on like the world's progression through drinking water and like its improvement over the years.
And then the decline
And then
slowly after that.
the extreme decline. Yeah. So I don't know. But sake and the mold brew, which is the koji, are just two different methods. So the rice brewing and the mold brewing have obviously different techniques and requirements, including what they are made from, which is the rice versus the mold. And so in 715 AD, there's the first record of actual brewing methods using mold, which is koji. So I don't know. I don't know if I've ever tried that.
No.
I don't know. So then in 1927 AD, sake brewing method were documented into the Code of Practice. So 10th century Code of Practice, Engishiki, reveals many of the customs and traditions related to sake around that period. It details the processes of how to brew it, which at this point was still governed by the imperial court, and the Engishiki also outlines a sake ranking system based on what brewing method was used. For example, only people in high ranks enjoyed rich flavored clear sake. The lower class could only share unrefined murky sake. And to this day, if you actually look at different sakes that there are, some of them have like fully clear, like there's nothing in it. Well, it looks like there's like a vodka or something. But then, similar to what you would maybe be looking at if you were going bourbon shopping, you'll see the different hues associated with different refinement of sake. And sometimes they
Right.
have particles and stuff in it as well. The lower class could only share that unrefined murky sake, and then furthermore, the sake was reserved for special occasions, like Blair was talking about. So, like their New Year's and festivals, you would offer drinks to your gods in, different rituals that you would have. And then, of course, it was occasionally heated in a special pot and accompanied by dried fish, shellfish, salt, and miso on the side. So then it became part of the traditional foods. A religious institution would then refine the basic brewing methods, and this was around 1233. There's a record of religious institutions making sake themselves. So from 12th and 14th centuries, the country's governing body shifted from the imperial court to the shogunate, which sake production began to shift as well in response. Brewing transferred from the court to shrines and temples, leading to what is called the birth of sake producers. These religious institutions treated sake as a commodity, and as a result, their high literacy rate and desire for profit led to a significant refinement in how it was brewed. In fact, the basic brewing technique developed around that time still resembles what's used today.
Nice.
And thanks to increased production, sake became, of course, more readily available to the general public, which is often what happens once it gets into like public hands. It just kind of takes off into the stratosphere. However, it was still kind of limited to those special occasions in terms of partaking in the sake. Conversely, by this time, the upper classes could enjoy it in smaller groups or by themselves, and the variety of food served with sake also expanded to include grilled fish, poultry, and simmered dishes, which is also just kind of a reflection of the food adjustments in that time frame as well and what was available.
Yeah, okay.
There's also commercial sake brewers that were starting to pop up because once it becomes popular, who wants to capitalize on it? Everyone.
Literally.
Literally everyone. In 1425, there's a record of 342 sake-related businesses in Kyoto alone, which is really cool. Brewers that specialized in making sake under their own trade names first appeared in that 13th century time frame, and their numbers would steadily increase from the 14th to 16th century, and as a result, religious institutions were no longer the dominant producers. I also just got a message that my internet is unstable, so that's super fun.
Well, you definitely started sounding like a robot about 2 minutes ago. So,
Perfect. If you can still hear me, listener, I swear the pod is still happening.
it's okay. Salem will do the rest of it.
He's honestly a pro
He's
in this
here.
situation. Hello, sir. I am a robot. You are cat. He's so stinking cute. That's how I want
Is.
Links to like, oh, never mind. He said bye. Look at my fancy
Look at my
butthole.
fancy
I will
butthole.
forever think about that TikTok.
I know. I know.
Oh my goodness. All right. Do I still sound grainy?
No, you sound better now.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Okay, so 1569, haha, ayo, first record of pasteurization in sake production is.
And we are 12 now.
I get it in when I can, okay?
That's what
Many.
she said.
Okay, I'm 12. That was a really good
You're welcome.
one. Many new developments occurred during this time period. Firstly, was the evolution in carpentry skills, which would lead to crafting those big wooden pails that would enable brewers to make larger quantities of sake at a time. Secondly, brewers in this period used a heat-based disinfection method, and the first record of that was in 1569. And interestingly, this was almost 300 years before the discovery of pasteurization, which was done by Professor Louis Pasteur, which is why it's called pasteurization, in the 1860s. So they kind of had it figured out. And I would just like to say, a lot of the time, technologically, Japan is very much ahead of the world, and I love that for them.
Yes.
Finally, the innovation of sake vessels offered a new and easy way to, quote, take away sake that previously had been either served on the spot or sold by wooden pails. This would allow people to enjoy the drink more casually with family and work colleagues, which is basically what happens now with other, alcoholic drinks. And sake in this period was usually served warm during colder months, and that was usually from September 9th to March 3rd, which makes a lot of sense because it's cold. You want
Totally.
something warm. It's like ice coffee season and warm coffee season.
Okay, but first of all, some people don't have that. Some people only
Yeah.
drink iced coffee.
That's true. I'm a warm coffee person almost
me
year
too.
round.
Me too. So this is how I divide it. It's
Yeah.
I am warm coffee in the mornings
Right.
and cold coffee any other time of day.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I'm a hot coffee 24/7, 365, you know? Like every now and then I'll drink the cold coffee, but I'm also doing the decaf, and it's harder to find decaf cold coffee that
Tell
tastes
me
good.
about it. Tell me about it. Okay, this is a full petition to Starbucks, really quick. Starbucks, your decaf coffee is
It's awful.
garbage.
And they have to do it
Garbage.
pour over. And I'm like, I do my
Yes.
own pour over with coffee and it tastes magnificent.
Yeah.
Yeah. It
I don't
tastes
know what's going
burnt.
on. I know that you like to put crack in your caffeinated coffee, which is why my heart palpitations get really fast.
Which is why we're
But like, I
decaf.
need you to have better decaf
Yeah.
because this is ridiculous.
And so last weekend when I had my meltdown and we went to that new coffee place, they did have other flavors of decaf coffee and I tried the French vanilla and I thought I'd ordered it hot, but they gave it to me cold. That's fine. But when I tried it, it wasn't my favorite coffee, but I did appreciate the effort
Yeah.
to brew it and make a cold decaf option that wasn't just burnt like bean water.
Yeah, we get the bag of decaf ground coffee from our local place, and it's so much better.
It
It's like a
is.
thousand times better than anything I can get at
Yeah.
Starbucks,
That's why
which,
we love it. Like, shout out to
yeah.
Custom Coffee. I know you don't listen to this podcast, but oh my gracious, they have the best coffee. And Tyler drinks it, so that's why I know it's good.
Yeah.
Anyway, all that to say, sake would become an industry production, which again is just kind of what happens as it becomes more popular, and this is with pretty much everything in life. In the 1600s, Itami became a star sake producer. So after the Tokugawa shogunate unified in Japan in 1603, the country experienced stable governance for the next 265 years. Freed from civil wars, many fields of production and distribution would blossom during this time, and also during these years make sake evolve from a local business to a extremely big industry. Osaka and the surrounding regions, particularly Itami, later Nara, became its star producers. Brands, trademarks, and rankings of sake would, of course, quickly follow. Therefore, to manage the increasing production, the government would control sake brewing and, of course, adjust the supply and pricing of rice so that it wasn't ridiculous for each
Crazy
individual.
pants, yeah.
Yeah, because that happens. And then in 1678, technological advancements would enable numerous developments in brewing methods. Firstly, a new rice milling technology facilitated the polishing of rice. This would lead to the production of what was called morohaku, or sake made exclusively with polished rice. It sounds super fancy. Secondly, to prevent microbial contamination, brewers in Itami employed a technique called hashira shochu. And during this process, spirits distilled from not like ghost spirits, like the spirits, the sake. Yeah. Spooky sake. I just want to be very clear. It's not like ghost spirits. But the spirits distilled from sake lees were added to sake before or after pressing. Lastly, brewing using the Komodo style yeast starter method became more exclusive to colder months, also to prevent contamination by microorganisms. For distribution, the sake was filled into cedar casks, covered with rice straw, and displayed along with a trademark. So fancy. In 1698, government record shows that there was over 27,000 brewers across the country. And then in the 1850s, there was the discovery of Miyamizu, which is water ideal for sake making, apparently. In Nishinomiya, excuse me, bringing sake production there. So the nation's capital, Edo, which is now Tokyo, housed over 1 million residents at that time. And this included many single men who came to take day-to-day jobs in the new city. As a result, copious amounts of sake flowed into the capital, which was around 90% of which came from Itami and Nara, and trade records show that the annual sake consumption per capita in Edo was up to 54 liters, which is 10 times higher than that of today. That's a lot of sake drinking. Essentially, what I amount this to is like the Japanese version of blue collar workers almost. Like, not necessarily blue collar jobs, but you have all of these single guys coalescing into the city with these probably highbrow, maybe laborious jobs that they have, and they're like, no, we need a drink. And I appreciate that.
No, I agree.
This was also partially due, reasonably, because it was readily available at restaurants and bars across the city. And so they would serve the drink with small dishes like sashimi, fish cakes, tofu, or marinated vegetables at affordable prices. And interestingly, sake was served warm all year round in the Edo period, and until well into the 20th century. So similar to me, they were
Interesting.
a hot drink only,
Yeah, I see that.
365. There were further refining methods, of course. It just gets more and more aggressively better. And again, this is similar to alcohol. It just significantly improved. There were obviously different methods that were created to do that. So 1872 was the first export of the sake, 1878, the first bottling of sake, 1895, identification of sake yeast, which is yabe. Yabe, I don't know. 1904, establishment of the National Research Institute of Brewing, which is crazy to think that there is one. I don't know if there is also one in anywhere else, or is that just Japan? I don't know. 1911 was the first annual Japan Sake Award by the National Research Institute of Brewing. And then in the 1940s, of course, there were wars happening. There was war-related food shortages, and this would also limit the production of sake. So during that time, there was rice shortages, and also if you have rice shortage and you're using that for the majority of your food, what you're not gonna do is turn it into alcohol necessarily. Like you're just gonna eat
Right.
the
No, that makes sense.
rice.
Specifically, this was World War II, just for
Yes.
everybody to clarify. Okay.
And then in 1943, the government introduced a grading system for sake taxation for the first time, which I'm sure people were less than pleased about. 1943, the grading system of sake was enforced by the government and then terminated in 1992, apparently. And then there was just a new flow overall. So this is after wartime. Things were starting to bounce back in the economy and the infrastructure. So, 1980s increase in trend of Ginjo-shu, an unpasteurized sake. It peaked in 1970, totally blasting through previous records in terms of post-war economic growth. And by this time, the development of necessary infrastructures such as machines and factories allowed for additional mass production over a really short period of time. So essentially, industrial revolution is what would advance a lot of these things.
Sure.
As a result, people would start to appreciate sake from other regions and focus on quality over quantity. And in the 1980s, companies would develop improved brewing techniques with new strains of yeast, and this would produce a fruity aroma, so cute, and the resulting fragrant sake Ginjo-shu would be enjoyed widespread. 1990, enforcement of sake brewing quality labeling standards. So it's getting out there, it's being exported readily. People want to know what they're consuming, and I think that's fair. And then 1990s on, the amount of sake production would actually start to decline. By the 2000s, there was an increased export, and the production of specialty designed sakes were going to take on regionality, apparently. I don't know. The development of the technology and infrastructure would have basically allowed the brewers to access markets in big cities from anywhere in the country, but it overshadows the value of the unique regional characteristics of the drink. And in recent years, influenced by the wine industry and its concept of something called terroir. I've never heard of this word in my entire life. But the sake industry had started to develop its own interpretation of sake regionality. So many prefectures were creating sake rice strains unique to their region. Neighboring brewers would start to collaborate to brew special editions. So to me, this is again like those micro brews and like the mini beer brew houses that we have that are regional and they use regional products. So essentially, they were doing that, but with sake. And that is the majority of the history. We kind of sped through that at the end, but basically, it's like I said, you've got infrastructure happening, industrial revolution happening, your exports are increasing, which means you kind of want to refine how it's done and maybe make more exclusive things so that people will drink your product. And in fact, I do know too that even in the States now, there are smaller breweries that will actually create sake here, which is interesting as well.
Oh, that is interesting. I've never seen that before.
We hadn't either. But at our local shop near us, they actually sell a few that are regionally made, which, again, very interesting. When we get back, we're going to talk about what you look for, how it's served, what kind of textures and smells you might be thinking about when you're looking to buy a sake or get into sake tasting. But for all of that, we'll see you in the second half.
We receive many questions regarding what exactly mediocre content podcast can be used for in the average person's daily life. Today, we will address this question head on with a list of everything you can do while listening to MCP. Kirsten, take it away.
Laundry, cooking, biking, hiking, driving, typing, working, walking, jumping, tattooing, swimming,
okay, Kirsten.
Launching a rocket, math homework, hopping, racing, singing,
all right,
showering, shaving,
I think they
swimming,
get it.
Jogging, eating, spinning, zooming, fishing,
Kirsten?
Boating,
hello?
Evening,
girl, can you hear me?
Taking out trash, gardening, building a house.
Okay, it appears we've lost her. Well, just so you know, you could do a lot of things while listening to Mediocre Content Podcast. So, yeah, that's the whole ad. And I'm going to go head over to the second half now. Kirsten, come on over when you're better. All right, bye, guys.
Not listening to your wife eating peanuts.
Welcome back. Hopefully you have had a nice break to digest all of the history of sake, and you're now ready to mentally start taste testing, because I obviously cannot give you any to taste test via the audio file.
Grab yourself a little drinky drink and a snack.
That's right. And tuck in, because this is a lot of information. So compared to other alcoholic drinks, and by other alcoholic drinks, I'm talking beer, wine, ciders, those things.
Spirits.
That's ooh. Spooky. Sake may actually seem more subtle in like someone who may just like be looking at it and be like, ah, it's probably just
and
a
that
clear
means
drink.
You're an alcoholic. No, I'm just kidding.
And that means get help. No. However, it's actually quite unique, and it has different categories of combinations of things. And to me, this actually sounds more like wine, if I'm being honest. So you've got
sure.
What it looks like, the aroma that comes from it. It has a texture, which makes me very unpleased. And then also flavor. So apparently those are separate. A standard sake tasting cup, which is important, is made of white porcelain with two navy rings printed on the inside of the cup. And once poured into the cup, the white porcelain makes it easier to evaluate these different pieces, such as the color, as the navy rings will create contrast and assess turbidity. That's a big word. You just look inside, you've got the contrast of the navy and the white, and you go, oh, that's this color. That's the point of the cup. So anyway.
Okay. All right.
So color is the first piece, because that's the first thing you see. There's freshly pressed sake, which will appear kind of a pale green or light yellow. This is also bottled without post-press filtration. Unfiltered sake or Marocca has this color. So if you want to know what to look for. Filtered sake, which is most sake, pasteurized or not, usually undergoes what's called charcoal filtration after it's pressed. So charcoal filtration will take away that yellowish tint and also additional unwanted flavors. There's aged sake, which reminds me a little bit of bourbon. And when aged, sake will gradually take on that amber hue that, you know, you might be used to if you're a bourbon person. And the longer the sake ages, of course, the darker that color will get. So all of that to say, color matters, because it will tell you, one, the process it went through, and two, the potential notes that it's about to have, which again is very similar to beer and things and bourbons. There's also clarity. So nigori is a coarse mesh for pressing produces white cloudy sake. This type of sake simply gets its name from the Japanese word for cloudy, which is adorable. Usu nigori, which is a semi-fine mesh, produces a slightly cloudy sake known as usi nigori. So it's still cloudy, but it's only slightly cloudy. We're about to be partly sunny. And then filtered, a fine mesh produces relatively transparent sake. Additionally, sedimentation and filtration further clarify turbidity. So it's just a clearer sake.
I like how you're predicting the weather.
I am. Partly cloudy with a chance of for turbidity, I guess.
That's right.
What mesh are you using? Is this cloud seeding? I don't know. Aroma, like we said, is another factor. So different brewing and aging methods will, of course, provide a wide array and spectrum of aromas from the sake. And this aroma encompasses anything from fruity, floral, nutty, roasted. For example, they have ginjo, a type of refined sake, and they say that this is usually fruity. And the notes in it are typically melon, banana, apple, citrus, and for some reason, it's just listed as green. I didn't realize green was an aroma, but maybe it just means like fresh or grassy or so. I don't know. Why? I don't know.
Have you seen the words that used to like describe wine? When
no,
let me look. Them up.
Okay, please feel free. It's probably very similar to like green.
literally.
I love that. While she's looking that up, though, the last two that they note are junmai, which is kind of a cereal, chestnut, pear, lychee kind of smell. And then the last one, of course, is that age. So you've got honey, kind of that soy sauce, nutty, spicy smell. And again, similar to bourbons and things of that nature. Texture is also important. So there's three different ones that they note in the article that we pulled. It's fizzy, standard, and creamy. Fizzy is a fresh sake that has slight carbon dioxide as a byproduct of alcohol fermentation in it. And some sake also undergoes secondary fermentation to achieve this fizzy texture. Additionally, some brewers add carbon dioxide to some of their products, particularly in the summer, because it's like, for me, drinking a polar water. I love the spicy water and I want a little fizz in my summer drinky drink, okay? Mm-hmm. The second is standard. The standard textured is smooth and has somewhat of a thick mouth feel, which I hate saying. So sorry if that makes you uncomfortable.
Thick mouth feel.
It's disgusting in my mouth just to think about it. But the filtration process will remove fine particles and carbon dioxide is already evaporated. So it literally is what they would compare to just a water texture. And then finally, creamy. Some types of sake have the smooth, creamy texture that is thicker than the standard sake. It's usually found in nigori, which is that cloudy one, and the coarse mesh used for pressing will give it that creamy texture and that cloudy look, because partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain.
Meatballs.
Taste. There are sugar, acid, and amino acids in particular that they kind of use as a method of deciding what it will taste like. So sake containing sugar content similar to semi-sweet wine, but unlike wine, which contains mostly fructose, the sugar in sake is actually mostly glucose. Acid, the acidity of sake is about 1/5 of wine, and the main acidic component is the succinic acid, and it's followed by lactic and malic acid. And then the last one is amino acids. So sake is rich in these, and they contain over 5 times more than wine and beer do. And these amino acids and peptides will produce the umami flavor found in sake.
Okay. So some of the fun words used to describe wine.
Yes.
Are barnyard.
Oh my God.
A wine that smells like farmyard animals.
Ew. First of all. If you have ever worked with farmyard animals, please don't drink that wine.
Grippy? Which means that it has like a tannin that sticks to the side of your mouth.
Ew, mouthfeel.
Mouthfeel. Leathery.
Oh my god.
Musky.
Ugh.
Some other ones are.
I like how you preface this with fun words that are used to describe. I think they're
funny. They're funny.
I think they're gross. I've decided I no longer want to drink wine.
zippy.
That means, one I could get behind.
Yeah. A lighter wine with like an aggressive flavor.
Sure. It's like that horse I rode. Zip.
Zip.
Zippity doodah.
Biscuit.
These sound like race horses that are like in the Kentucky Derby. Barnyard, zippy, leathery. well, that mouthfeel. Yeah, definitely horse names.
Opulent.
Didn't he win last year?
This is how they name the horses. They just on the wine descriptor chart. Yeah.
Oasis is next, I'm sure.
Easel is one of them.
That is definitely a horse name. Or it is a American pit bull.
Either one.
Either one.
That's
very
like
possible.
The sweetest dog you've ever met.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Oh my god. One of them is cat's pee?
Ew! Okay. Ugh. All right. Y'all are disgusting.
I don't know. Anyway, we're going to stop that.
Please, god. We're going to stop. Thank you for introducing cat's pee to my wine tasting list. Wow. All right. Well, that's disgusting.
I mean, they'd be using their adjectives at the wine tasting.
Bro, if you're looking for new animal names that you've never tried or heard of before, go to that list because there's plenty to choose from.
That's how you're going to name your next pet.
Absolutely. Say less. Okay, so there is also sake taste composition and impression. How did you feel? Impressed? Potentially. So there's a sweetness. So sake tastes sweet when the sugar content is high, obviously, and the acidity is low, obviously. And sake is relatively low acidity compared to semi-sweet wine, gives it that sweeter impression. However, acidity provided by succinic acid and the lactic acid can mask the sweet taste even with relatively high sugar content. And this will result in more of a full body taste rather than the simple sweet flavor. Body is stated as while sugar and umami enrich the taste of sake, acidity will provide the structure. So full-bodied sake, usually have relatively high levels of acidity, sugar, and umami compounds. On the other hand, sake with low sugar content and umami compounds will tend to have the lighter taste. So it just kind of depends on what you would prefer. And then finally, finish. And I feel like I've heard finish before in wine tasting. What's the finish? What's the body? Whatever. Yeah. Unlike wine, a long-lasting aftertaste isn't really desired as a trait in sake. And instead, you want like this light, clean finish where once you sip it and you've got the taste in and you swallow, it's not just continuing to hit the back of your throat and create additional notes.
Yeah.
Didn't I sound so professional right there?
You did. You're a connoisseur.
I feel a little bit of barnyard in the back of the throat. Okay, and then the other piece to this is the temperature and aging conditions. So temperature is very interesting when it comes to sake because in America, if you don't have a cold beer, it's typically not great. And I feel like that's because of how it's manufactured specifically for the American backyard festival where you're having like ice cold beer. It's coming straight from the tap.
Festival.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
You mean a cookout?
No. I mean a backyard festival. Sounds much more regal when you say it like that.
It does.
I don't want to reduce it to the barbecue.
What do you think I'm doing this weekend? I'm having a backyard festival.
That's what people in mansions call it.
Right.
But if you look at other parts of the world, such as Europe, sometimes they have warm beer and potentially their methods are specific to people partaking in the drink in that condition. I don't know if that's making any sense.
It could also just be the culture.
It's culture related as well.
Yeah.
In this case, There are specific sakes that you would manufacture for different temperatures and different conditions, as well as some that can kind of go beyond or go between these different methods. But they'll usually list how to serve it on the type of sake that you receive. So it's unique in that because of this, and I would argue this is the same for things like beer too, temperature will change the taste depending on, you know, how it affects sweetness, umami, acidity, etc. And so here are the characteristics of the same sake at two different serving temperatures. This was just examples that they gave us, compared to sake at 25 degrees Celsius as the control, so essentially room temperature. So if a sake is chilled, it should be sitting between 8 to 10 degrees Celsius, and the taste is expected to be light, fresh, sweet, or less sweet, sorry, and umami. The aroma will probably be on the fruitier side and slightly viscous in texture. At room temperature, as the control, it's just a subtle, smooth, modest aroma, kind of baseline taste. If you then warm that sake to 40 to 50 degrees Celsius, the taste is expected to be full and sweet, and the umami is a little more robust. The aroma will be more of a cereal, nutty flavor, or nutty smell, I'm sorry, and the texture will be less viscous. So it does affect how it's partaken in, and then again, like I said, some are specifically made to be at certain temperatures when served. And then, of course, aging, like other things, that also affects color, aroma, taste. You've got fresh, which is just fresh out the box, maybe aged 5 years. You've got a lighter color and more of a nutty taste and aroma. And then aged 20 years, you got that dark amber color that you would maybe associate with a stout. And it's kind of more of like a dried fruit, soy saucy kind of aroma and very complex in its taste. So again, very similar to how you would brew other things. The only difference is like they specify how it's served, and also the method in which it is brewed is different. So then the final thing that I just want to talk about is the etiquette in serving, as well as the vessels that you're expected to have when serving sake. And it's different in that, say in America, because this is the only example I have, because I haven't ventured far out into the world to drink beer and things. But in America, you could have a bottle, you could have a can, you could have a red solo cup. That beer will taste different, potentially, in all of those different vessels, but there isn't really any etiquette. If you're going to your backyard festival, it's kind of whatever they serve or you bring.
Similar to the way that you get your Diet Coke.
True.
Is different. It tastes different in each vessel.
And we have very strong feelings about that as Diet Coke drinkers.
Yeah, we do.
But that's like, so, but there isn't really any etiquette, right? Like if you go to a gas station, they're not required to serve Diet Coke in a can or Diet Coke in a bottle, right? If you Correct. Go to a restaurant, you're not going to expect like, oh, I will only have it served in. No, you get the McDonald's cup and you drive away. Okay. Sake yeah. is different. The temperature, like we said, is very important. So there are specific cups and vessels and varieties of materials that make it safe, number one. So like glass doesn't explode in a microwave or something.
Right.
But also provides it a range to either maintain hot or maintain cold depending on the vessel. And that's true. So like if you get a hot coffee, you don't want it in something that's going to distribute that heat and make it cold fast. And this is a similar concept. So additionally, when it comes to temperature, sake is a drink that acts kind of like a vehicle of communication during drinking groups in Japan, apparently. And therefore, understanding this basic etiquette is important because you're usually doing it in a group setting. So serving others, sake is a drink that acts like this vehicle. And therefore, when you're serving a group, you must keep an eye on how much is left in the other's cup, of course. This would also just be a regular host situation at a party or your festival. And if their drink is nearly empty, you will always make sure to ask or signal if they want to be topped off, pour, paying attention to others' needs and showing consideration and gratitude for their company. Holding cups, when you hold a sake cup, you must hold it between the thumb, forefinger, and middle finger. So you're kind of pinching it in between those first three fingers.
Pinkies up.
Pinkies up. And when being served, you place your other hand beneath the cup for support, because if you drop it, first of all, if it's hot, ouch. Second of all, you've just wasted sake.
Rude.
And now it's in your lap.
Party foul.
Party foul, exactly.
Or backyard festival foul.
Backyard festival foul. How you hold the vessels is also important. So when serving sake, you will use both hands. You will hold the main neck of the vessel with your dominant hand and place the other hand at the bottom to maintain its steadiness. And then toasting. So when you make a toast in Japan, the equivalent of like cheers or kenpai. So while the literal translation is dry the cup, so you're drinking, you're toasting and then you're drinking. So that makes sense. People aren't actually expected to just shot it down, okay? It's a sipping situation. It's not like you clink, you drop it on the table, and then you do your shot with your lime. It's just to say cheers, and then you take a sip. So please don't shot the sake, is what I'm trying to tell you. You could, but maybe etiquette-wise, not the best choice. There aren't really rules technically to how much has to be drunk during the toast. So you just sip, or in Blair's case, shot it. Apparently.
Well, so the little cups that they use for sake are.
Yeah, they're smaller.
They're like a shot glass.
But
not to be confused with the shot glass.
For sure. And yeah. But the difference is when, in my experience, and I have very limited experience, so maybe Tyler could speak better on this than me, but he's not here, so I'm all you got.
We'll ask him on Sunday during right. the Girl Scout thing.
And maybe we can show you some of the things that we have that are really cool containers that we've okay. found recently. But anyway, it doesn't matter. What I will say is a shot of like vodka or something of that nature is vastly different than trying to shot sake. I don't really know if it's what it's made out of or its specific content. I don't know. But when you shot tequila or something, I've done a shot of tequila. It doesn't taste great to me, and it definitely burns. If I try to do a shot of sake, I am in tears within the first sip because it's so much.
Yeah, it's like, just so potent.
It's so aggressive. So yeah. Feel free to give it a go. But it's
I'm not
very
saying
different.
That I want to. I'm just saying that like a lot of people probably would or have.
That's oh no, all. They probably have for sure. Yeah. I just wouldn't recommend it. Do the tequila shots. That's fine. Okay, never mind.
Have you ever done a pickle shot before?
No, and that sounds repulsive.
It was actually pretty good.
I will eat the pickle more than I'll drink the juice. That sounds weird. Anyway, the other thing you should drink is water. That's the final
Don't
thing.
Don't forget.
Please drink water. So I attribute the alcohol content to be one of the reasons that it's more difficult to shot successfully.
Sure, yeah.
So sake has relatively 15% in it. And so it's advised to drink water in between servings, which I would advise anyway, regardless of what you're drinking.
Yes,
just
mom.
Just to be careful. And of course, this prevents excessive drinking or hangover. This is just normal, okay? Just drink water.
Liquid IV, Pedialyte, whatever floats your boat.
1,000%. And then finally, we'll talk briefly about the different vessels that you might expect to receive sake in. So again, there's not really strict rules. It just depends on how it's being served and what the parameters are. So temperature, you don't want to put it in glass. Like, it's just going to, the heat's just going to escape really fast. However, the rule of thumb is to remember shape, thickness, and how it will affect the taste, and examples are as follows. Ceramic are the most common cups used to drink sake, and they are small, like Blair said, so it kind of looks like a shot glass, but they usually have really ornate pictures or colors, mm-hmm. or, you know, it's really more of a, if you're thinking about tradition and, like, group gatherings, it's quite fancy. I would say.
Yeah, it's like a little teacup without the handle.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, that varies too in terms of what kind of set that you get. But famous pottery areas across Japan make the sake cups with materials and designs unique to that region, which is also cool. And mm-hmm. many consider that matching the origin of the cup with the region of sake production is a really sophisticated way of drinking.
Cute.
But there is glassware, so sake can be used to drink the sake. Small glasses are usually up to that 110 milliliters, and usually wine glasses aren't always used, but it can also be used if you'd like to, especially if you're drinking it more for the aroma that you're experiencing. There is something called lacquerware, which is usually used for special occasions like weddings and New Year celebrations. So it's kind of like the bride and groom's toasting glasses, for example. However, throughout ancient history of sake, people of high ranks were served sake using this lacquerware at banquets and ceremonies. So fancy. And then there's wooden sake cups. So these are used at ceremonies and festivals, and sake is sometimes offered in these small wooden box called a masu. The masu was originally used as a measuring cup for rice. However, recently is it occasionally used to serve food and drinks. Regardless of the shape, wooden cups do add a fragrant wooden aroma to the sake. So just keep that in mind. If you are looking to just taste the sake and not have any outside influence, you might not want to use the wooden version. There's a category called playful cups, and it's just a unique item for extra fun and incitement for drinking sake. There's temperature sensitive cups that, you know, will change color or provide designs like your insulated mugs so you pour your hot drink into.
Sure.
And then sake vessels. So it's usually brought out to the table as a ceramic 300 milliliter vessel in a size called tokori, and ochoshi. And it can also come in a bowl with a spout called katakuchi. And when drinking warm sake, it's first warmed in the tokori or a metal vessel called a churori and then poured into the actual serving vessel. And with all of that long-winded knowledge, that's all I have on sake.
Yay. Also, if you can't hear me, it's because Jinx moved my microphone with his head.
Thanks, Jinx. We appreciate it. He just wanted to give his two cents on it, too. What do you think, son?
I don't think he cares that much, to be honest.
Rude. Well, you know what? We'll get a cat bowl for sake. And we'll...
Oh, yeah.
A playful cat bowl of sake. This has been, I really enjoy this. And if you are listening to this in May, you have missed the Girl Scout cookie stream, but that's okay because you can watch it on YouTube and maybe we don't talk to Tyler about his experience with sake and maybe show you a couple of bottles. So if you want to check that out, maybe go to our YouTube because I'll have posted it by then, hopefully.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think, yeah, no, it'll be good. We're really looking forward to the Girl Scout cookie thing.
I keep
remembering because we put the box in the pantry and I keep remembering that it's there and I'm just like, wow, it's gonna be so much fun.
Look, I can't put my box in the pantry because the stupid, who puts baseboard heating in the pantry where everything will just like melt?
Oh my okay? God.
So it's sitting out on the table and I walk by it every day.
That's terrible. I know. Why are you doing that to yourself? You hate yourself.
I do, just a little bit, right?
Oh my God. All right. Well, that wraps up mediocre content for this week. Please feel free to send us an email with any questions, comments, concerns, or episode topic suggestions at mediocrecontentpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram or TikTok or Twitch at mediocrecontentpodcast, or catch up with us every other Thursday on Twitch at 3 p.m. PST, 6 p.m. EST, or 11 p.m. BST. Don't forget to rate us 5 stars anywhere you listen to podcasts, and we will see you next week. This has been Mediocre Content.
Thanks so much for listening. Cheers!
Cheers!